Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Imprudent King, A New Life of Philip II, by Geoffrey Parker. Narrated by Nigel Patterson. Conventions. Where an established English version of a foreign place name exists, Antwerp, Corunna, Geneva, The Hague, Vienna, I have used it. Otherwise, I have preferred the style used in the place itself today. Mechelen, not Malines. Aachen, not Aix-la-Chapelle. Likewise, where a standard English version of the style and title of an individual exists, William of Orange, Don John of Austria, I have used it. Otherwise, I have preferred the version used by the individual. One exception is Antoine Perrenot de Granvelle, 1517-1586. Although he used the style Bishop of Arras between 1540 and 1562, and thereafter Cardinal Granvelle, he appears throughout this book as Granvelle. To avoid confusion and facilitate comparisons, all sums of money mentioned in this book have been given in Spanish ducats, each one roughly equivalent in the later 16th century to one escudo, or crown, and to 2 florins. About 4 ducats made up £1 sterling. On the 24th of February 1582, Pope Gregory XIII ordered all Christians to advance their calendar by 10 days, but different countries adopted the new style at different times. In Spain, the 15th of October 1582 immediately followed the 4th of October. In most of the provinces of the Netherlands in rebellion against Philip, the 25th of December immediately followed the 14th of December 1582. In the loyal provinces, the 22nd of February 1583 immediately followed the 11th of February, and so on. All dates in this book after the 4th of October 1582 appear in new style, unless otherwise stated, even for states like England that rejected the Gregorian calendar. And throughout I have assumed that each calendar year began on the 1st of January, and not on the 25th of March, as in the old style or Julian calendar. In preparing this edition, I have corrected some minor errors. I thank Geoffrey Northrup and Patrick Lenehan for bringing them to my attention. Preface. Maria José Rodríguez Salgado, my friend and colleague for 35 years, once wrote, "I have spent more time with Philip II than with any other man. Indeed, one could say that I have devoted the best years of my life to him." I could say the same. I began documentary research for a biography of the king in the 1960s, taking as my core source the holograph memoranda he exchanged with his leading advisers, documents once in the Altamira collection, but now divided between repositories in New York, Madrid, Geneva, and London. In 1978, Little Brown of Boston published Philip II in their series The Library of World Biography. But since then, thousands more holograph memoranda, formerly in the archive of the Counts of Altamira, have entered the public domain. Those in the Biblioteca de Zabalburu in Madrid remained closed to researchers until 1987 because of a disputed inheritance, while no one saw those in the vaults of the Hispanic Society of America in New York between the time they were filed away by the King's secretaries and 2012, when they were identified and catalogued. The Altamira documents are unique. The king transacted as much business as possible in writing, and his messages to senior ministers, often scribbled in the margins of their reports to him, addressed information, petitions, and problems that came to his desk from all over the world. He resolved some matters in a single document, others in a series of exchanges spread over several days, and still others in several exchanges on the same day. In many cases, Philip lapsed into a logorrhea that not only revealed the thought processes that underlay his decisions, but also shared details on his personal life. When and where he ate and slept, what he had just read, which trees and flowers he wanted to plant in his gardens, and where, how problems with his eyes, his legs or his wrist, or a cold or a headache had made him fall behind with his paperwork. Many messages also dealt with what his ministers disparagingly called trivia, menudencias, decisions which they considered unnecessary. Should a Morisco boy who claimed he could divine water go to the Pardo Palace, where the gardens needed irrigation? Yes, but he would get only one chance. Where should his builders locate the toilets, necesarias, at the Escorial? Let these toilets be situated in a place where the kitchen staff can't smell them, although, to make the right decision, I would like to see the plans of the water conduits. The king's addiction to trivia irritated and sometimes infuriated his ministers, in part because the same document that commented on water diviners or locating toilets might also convey a decision vital to the fate of the monarchy: how to persuade Don John of Austria to go to the Netherlands and become governor-general, whether or not to sign a ceasefire with the Ottoman Sultan, when and how to invade England, to take three examples from a single year, 1576. In most of his rescripts, the king shifted between public and private affairs without warning, as different ideas entered his mind. His overworked ministers therefore needed to read every word he wrote. So must historians. Even with this wealth of personal material, writing the king's biography is not easy. Philip boasted that, "I began to rule in the year 1543, the year in which his father, Emperor Charles V, named him regent of Castile and Aragon, and between 1554 and 1556 he became in succession king of Naples and England, ruler of the Netherlands, and monarch of Spain, Sicily, and Spanish America." In 1565, Philip's subjects began the conquest of the Philippines, which they named in his honour, and between 1580 and 1583 he acquired Portugal and all its overseas possessions. Thereafter, he ruled the first global empire in history until he died in 1598, aged 71. The extent of his monarchy, combined with the long duration of his reign, present Philip's biographers with the first of four major interpretive obstacles: an excess of data. As the distinguished Hispanist Pascual de Gallangos observed in the mid-19th century, as he transcribed some of the hundreds of thousands of documents written and read by the king, the history of Philip II is in a way a history of the world. And William Hickling Prescott, the historian for whom Gallangos prepared those transcripts, began his three-volume study of the king with a claim only slightly more modest. The history of Philip II is the history of Europe during the latter half of the 16th century. Although Gallangos and others compiled over 15 fat volumes of transcripts for Prescott, these constitute only a fragment of the surviving documentation. On one occasion, the king claimed he had signed 400 letters in a single morning, and a well-informed ambassador asserted that on some days 2,000 documents passed across the royal desk. Philippizing, as Prescott termed his work on the king, is a lifetime commitment. Paradoxically, the second major interpretive obstacle facing Philip's biographers seems to contradict the first. Even if a diligent historian managed to consult all the relevant papers that survive, many of the king's decisions would remain impenetrable. Although Philip committed more of his thoughts and decisions to paper than almost any other ruler, he deliberately left others in obscurity, and at all times he urged his ministers to proceed with secrecy and dissimulation, con secreto y disimulación, one of the commonest phrases in his vocabulary. Sometimes he deliberately laid down his quill because this is a matter to talk about, not to write about. And at other times he tried to destroy all written evidence specifically to conceal what he had done and why. In addition, as Philip's father once warned him, "Some political decisions are so impenetrable and uncertain that I do not know how to describe them to you, because they are full of confusions and contradictions, either because of the state of affairs or because of conscience." Like his father, Philip took some decisions for reasons that neither he nor his closest advisers could fully explain. Thus, in 1571, Philip's irrepressible enthusiasm for a totally unrealistic plan to kill or capture Elizabeth Tudor left his counsellors mystified. "It is remarkable to see how committed His Majesty has become to this English business," wrote Dr. Martin de Belasco, a pragmatic legal expert who had served the king for over 20 years. And he marvelled how the news that the Queen, Elizabeth, knows all about his plan, has scarcely cooled his ardor. Therefore, Velasco...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?